So welcome, welcome everyone. Nice to see you. So the talk is a continuation of the theme that I have been speaking about now for some time called birthing of the heart. And its ways, different strategies, sometimes encouragements or homeworks that allow us to sort of change the figure ground relationship of our lives, and I'll explain to you what I mean. Most of us spend much of our spiritual lives on the wrong side of reality. And what I mean by that is that the sense of self, it's not, the sense of self is the fiction, not reality. And we keep trying to work with the fictional part of ourselves make the adjustments necessary so that we can approach or touch or connect with reality. And we do that by any number of strategies. Usually those strategies are on the wrong end. They are strategies from the way I am toward reality, and I need to do something about the way I am in order to have some connection with reality. So we're on the wrong side of the page. And what this series is meant to do is to put us on the right side of the page. It's a little bit like, our self-image is a little bit like a one-way mirror. And if you've ever been in a one-way mirrored room, you get a massive reflection back on who's in the room, but you really can't pierce that one-way mirror image to see through the mirror, to see what's outside that surround. And it's very convincing when you only live within that room, you only see your image. And the image then evokes certain responses from us. We have to live compatibly with the image, and so we make the necessary adjustments. None of that really makes it easier to see through the image to the reality that exists just on the other side of the mirror. And so, in fact, what we have to do is approach the mirror, which has its analogous side to meditation. We have to approach the mirror and see if we can not look at the image so much as to see if we can look and hold our glance so that we see through the image. The image itself is too captivating. If we just sit there and watch the image, we'll never have any motivation to be able to see through the image. But if you hold your gaze steady and you don't look at the image, you look at the mirror, you can pierce that reflection and see what's on the other side of the glass. And so too, the image of ourselves is very strong. It's equally as strong as the one-way mirror. And it's very, very difficult. And that's why it seems to take so long in the course of our lives to move this journey, even in the slightest way, so that those images don't bear the force and burden that they have from the past. But as we learn how to work our gaze, how we learn to hold our awareness, our attention, we begin to see through the images. The images don't contain the oppression that they do when we're just in the room moving in relationship to them. And so as we learn to quiet ourselves sufficiently, what arises, the mental formations that arise within the mind, don't bear the same force and the same identifying link they have in the past as we begin to quiet down sufficiently and hold our attention properly within ourselves. Those images begin to be seen through. Now we're switching to the wise and right side of reality. We're no longer convinced in the same way we were that the images hold the basis of the facts of reality, but that reality is something else outside of how we have perceived it. In fact, the images are so ubiquitous and so complete and so uniform that even how we view, even when we view through the mirror, we still hold the images of what we expect to see on the outside. So that the objects external to us still hold our image, our remembrance, our memories, our convictions, our past within their own identification. So it's a long, laborious journey, not so much because it's a far distance we have to travel. It's simply that we haven't learned how to be on the wise side of reality. We're too convinced that the sense of me holds the truth, and we are reluctant to put forth the full-hearted energy to see that that is not the way reality is arranged. So what does that have to do with what we're doing here? Well, it has everything to do with it, because what we're attempting in this series is to switch the figure and ground. We're attempting to see that the heart is available to us all the time. That if we use the old strategies from the images and try to work our way or try to force love into us, try to force love upon us, try to make ourselves worthy of love, try to rearrange our inward life so that we have enough space for love, we sense that we fail, and we do. Why? Because love is the reality. We're the fiction. We don't have to do anything to bring the reality in. We have to do something about the belief in the fiction, in the images, to let reality in. So the willingness to release the invested meaning we've given life in our words and our thoughts and our emotions and our story and our narrative and our commentary, all the ways that we lace ourselves together, to sort of begin to question that and begin to see through that, begins to allow the heart to shine. So you might say we're forcing love outside of ourselves. We're forcing love to take an external relationship to us when it's all around us. And that's why it's very hard for me to listen to teachings that suggest a cultivated relationship to love. Because cultivation is on the wrong side of reality. You don't have to work for love. Love is your birthright. Love is the correct orientation to life. Another analogy that I think shows that perhaps even more poignantly is the one that I use sometimes in terms of the projector on a screen. The projector, the light goes through an image, and the image is projected in a cinema onto the screen. But the image is light. There isn't something else that the image is made of. It's made of the light. It's just that the various grays and colorations of the light throw our attention off. And we start believing in the play of the dance of the coloration and forget all about the light. Now the light in this metaphor is the love of life, is awareness. It's everywhere. It's just that who cares about it when you can follow the image and the story of the images? They dance across the screen, they make a great, may even make an Oscar-winning nomination here, if we play our cards right. And they evoke a story from us, they evoke a purpose and intention, they evoke all of that. And so we keep and constantly get lost in the surface, literally the surface imagery of reality, when the depth of reality contains much, much more than what we offer it. So, I mean, I'm not just talking from books. This is actually the experience that each of us can have in the room. And that's what awakening is. When one awakens to the figure ground switch of what the truth is in terms of reality and the images that we have falsely believed within. And so that doesn't mean that the mental formations are, there's nothing, you know, valuable about them. In fact, we have to balance availability of the light with the formations that occur. In other words, you have to also see the light on the screen of the movie even as the movie plays itself through. Because the sense of the without the images, you lose your functionality in life. Like common question I get from relatively new people in the practice is, I love the present moment, but how do I plan in relationship to the present? It just seems like planning takes me outside. Well, we all have to plan, don't we? And that's the balance between the image formation and the light and the love that's present. And so is it that we can abide within the light and do whatever the images compel us to do, because they're continuing to move? The cinema, just realizing that we're the light on which the images are displayed, doesn't stop the images from moving. They continue to move. Our lives continue to turn and move in action, and we have to respond to what's appropriate for us to do within that. And if to catch an airplane a month from now, I better call and make reservations. So that ability to stay with both simultaneously, to be fully embodied within the light, never being falsely interpreting the images to be the true reality, but at the same time functionally moving within life so that everything is done so that it works in proper sequence. You can't wait until after your flight to call for a reservation. So that's what we're doing here. And so when we're calling the heart out, we're shifting our figure ground. For some of you, that may be an obvious shift. For many of you, it isn't. For many of you, it feels very troubling inside of ourselves, very disturbing, and very dark in there. We don't see how there could be any light in relationship to this dark angst that we embody. And so a lot of work has to be done at that level of personality and behavior and history for us to begin to lighten the load of our psychology and our psyche so that we can begin to sense ourselves as being more than the kind of damnation of image that we have lived with up until now. So these two things, psychological transformation and spiritual transcendence, they're really one in the same adventure. It's whether you stop at the transforming quality of the personality and rest with that alteration that has just occurred. You know, now I'm a very happy, friendly guy, no longer sour, and that's satisfactory enough for me to just rest upon my laurels. Or you just keep moving yourself more and more into the light until even the reference of self becomes so vague and transparent that it isn't even used. So you can get a sense of where you are in the balance of this form to formlessness, images to light, I'm just using different metaphors, as to how your heart responds in terms of formation. Like you take love, for instance. Love as expressed in its absolute terms as light is just there. It's just embracing. It doesn't pressure you. It doesn't judge you. There's no sense of any weight or burden from love. It simply is a revealing quality. But love, when it comes down and is ratcheted into the mental formations of the images, becomes possessive, because that's how images relate. They relate as a personal set of preferences and against other images that they perceive as being similar or dissimilar to themselves. And then love becomes a self-possession. It becomes, I love you more than I love him. And it's quantified, because once you have that kind of prescribed object, you have quantification. You have three of those and four of those, and you've got more love for this and less love for that, and it all gets very very weighty and very privileged and manipulative. So you can see where you are, where we all are, just by how it is that you look out upon the simple ability to love life. When you just hold life in its total inclusivity. You see, this is the figure ground switch that each of the Brahma Viharas take us through. Metta, metta switches us from the exclusivity of mind formation love. I love you, but I don't love her. Right? That's the way the mind organizes its love, to inclusivity. That's the figure ground switch. An image that thinks like an image can't make that switch. So in order for you to make that switch, you have to let go of the self-formation. That's what has to occur. That's the only trouble, that's the only difficulty there is on the path. You have to let go of the image, the false reality, to ascribe and to sit in the real one. And so we start out very circumscribed. We start out saying, okay, may you be happy, and you know, I have some, may you be a little happy, because I don't really, don't like you as well, but I'm trying to. And you back there who are difficult, may you be something, and I'll get around to liking you as this thing. So anyway, so as we began to soften in relationship to the images we see, we take the pressure off of them, we take our opinionation off them, we take our judgment off of them, through metta, through the metta practice, all right, the images don't become as pronounced. And now I find there's a heart connection. I find I can like you where I didn't like you before. I don't necessarily like your behavior. I still disagree with the things you do, but as a human being, I can see that we have a lot in common, and it's from that commonality that I can allow myself to greet you kindly. So that's the way metta has, we've talked about metta moving. And karuna, compassion, we talked about earlier, and that, you know, that's a setup that moves from someone's suffering and not caring, basically not caring about people who are in pain, and thinking that they got what they deserved, you know. So, you know, sort of, you can feel much of the political arena carved out in that sort of entrenched way of thinking. You know, that there's not enough for everyone, so just give me my share here and the others can go wanting. And as you begin to soften, you begin to feel the empathy of the conditions that everyone is under, because you too know your own conditionality. And so the images begin to, the burden of the images begin to lift off, and the heart begins to genuinely, empathetically connect where it never did before. And when it does that, it's moving into and through the formation, self-formation of love and self-contained love, and begins to open to be more embracive, which is the definition of universality of love, so that it can start feeling the conditions under which we are all under. But you can see that the light from the images, and the images are together in this. That is, the love of feeling someone else's pain necessitates that I recognize that they're in pain. The functional relationship is there. I'm down at the level of formation. You're hurting, and I care that you're hurting. I'm hurting, and I care that I'm hurting. So for karuna, or compassion, to be there, there has to be formation. There can't just be kind of non-functionality, living in some kind of bliss state of the universal God is all, that's ridiculous. This is down-to-earth image. Is even though at the same time we realize that the images aren't true, not in an absolute sense, you still, that doesn't stop love from engaging them with a caring compassion. No one gets left out of this thing. You see. Now we're talking about mudita. Mudita is the natural response of the heart to joy. So when you see somebody uplifted, a winner, somebody just won the Powerball, $500 million. And God, how come I didn't get it? I mean, that's the formative expression. If you're just in the form, the image of yourself, it's like, damn, how come I didn't go to that place and get that Powerball number? See, that's the way that most of us relate to our life most of the time. But I'll show you that it's available to you instantaneously. And here's a perfect example. To show you that mudita rides complete, 100%, absolute, in you at all times, as long as the image doesn't betray that connection. Okay? And this is the example. When all of us have been around infants, and if you're with an infant and the infant just brightens up and starts laughing or just has a big smile, and everyone's heart universally gladdens. You don't say, how come he's happy and I'm not? There's no competition there, you see. Everyone's heart, because everyone holds it all the time. It's just the competitiveness. It's harder to do that when your chief competitor just won the grant and you didn't, isn't it? Same thing. It's just that other one evokes a stronger set of images from you. You see? But if you ever want to know your heart in full access, don't ever question it. Just go hang out with young kids. They'll make you smile, they'll make you laugh. Hearing children play, suddenly you're like, whoa. This is what it means to be alive. And you say, we all hold that. You know, we get so narrowed in on what it means to be to have a heart that we miss the full-hearted display that's there frequently. You know, as we tighten down around our own needs, it's like trying to look at life through a pea shooter. You know, you get this little teeny, like a straw. And it's so narrow. The focus is so narrow. It's no wonder that we don't delight anything. We don't take it in order to delight it. And then our history immediately comes forth to rob us of the pleasure. The image, right? Who we've been, our melees, our difficulties, our troubled life, our past. You know, my mother didn't give me enough love. All of that stuff keeps us disabled, keeps us looking through the pea shooter for love. And that disability maintains itself. And so when we find ourselves jealous and envy, rather than gladden. You see, you begin to realize that what mudita holds is abundance. So abundance, so that's an interesting word. To look at life abundantly. Now, this is very important. You know, you say, okay, well, I can see the glass half filled instead of half empty. That's how I change myself from scarcity to abundance. Well, that's helpful. That changes your attitude associated with life, you know, and it does uplift. But that's not the Dharma. The Dharma isn't, you know, convincing yourself that something is this way and not that. It's seeing the truth of something. And so it's not talking ourselves into a different arrangement of life so that we can see it from a different angle. I mean, then it would just be, you know, it would just be adaptation. All we'd have to do is adapt to a new way of looking and we'd all be fine and dandy. It's not that. Abundance, you see, isn't really looking at life in terms of quantifying reference. It doesn't look life like there's not enough here, right? Your heart never says that. The heart always has a sense of sufficiency. When we are resting not in the image, not in the forsaken reality of ourselves, which is always the way formations, you know, assess one another is terms of quantification and scarcity. Well, she got that and I didn't, and she won and I lost, and he's better than I am, and jealousy, I'm jealous of, and I'm envious that they've got a bigger house than mine, and they live on this, and So that's the way formations live. Abundant, there's no abundance. Abundance is a missing word, you see. But as we begin to loosen the contraction of all of that way of seeing, as the pea shooter broadens its scope, as we become more comfortable within our emotional life, so that each emotion doesn't contain us and give us a self-driven story, that only this is true about me. As these things relax within us, you're seeing then how the meditation directly affects your heart and your perception and your access to abundance. Because now, when we look out from a relaxed view rather than a contracted view, abundance no longer is quantifiable. It's not about how much he has compared to how much I have. It's that was only the description of abundance within mental formation, within me, right? What's the reality of abundance? Is that there's always ample. Well, you say, you know, I don't have it. No, you see, as soon as we go back into what I do or do not have, we're back in the formation of our image, and we've lost the sense of abundance. There is a perception of reality that is complete and total, and nothing has changed within that perception and the perception of the limited sense of me that was there right before that. Nothing gets altered. I don't now have more money. It's just that's not how reality is. It's not quantified. It doesn't look for piles to determine accomplishment. It doesn't look at, you know, how much happiness he seems to have and how much, you know, unhappiness. It's not like that. That's not an emotional equivalent either. It's just that this is enough. You're alive, aren't you? That's enough. And you have to care for the image as it moves through the cinema. I'm not suggesting that it's enough and you just sit outside never eat, you know, and just let people rob you. It's enough. It's enough. I can do, you know, or somebody's abusing you at home. Yeah, this is an, I can do, you know. No, I'm not suggesting that at all. At the same time, we move functionally with the images, doing what is ever necessary. Whatever's necessary. If I need more money, I earn more money. But there's never a sense of inward poverty. That's a really good phrase. There may be external poverty, but I'm working towards overcoming that. But there's never inward poverty. This isn't magic. This is simply crossing over. We're already on the screen, the cinematic screen. So is abundance. If we look through the image, abundance, where abundance here is, isn't clear. Because we're looking from one image to the next. If we look resting in the light, we haven't changed places. All of the action is occurring within that one frame. And yet the whole thing has changed. Everything has changed. There's sufficiency now, where there never was. And I'm moving completely appropriately with the rest of the images. I haven't become dysfunctional, which is what so many people fear. You know, if I give myself over to the light, well, I just sit out, you know, and say, well, God will take care of everything. Well, you can do that and God won't take care of everything. You see, now, from the sense of the light holding the images, now you're no longer in a room with a one-way mirror. That's the thing, you've broken out. You have both access, the images, and the light. Now we can dance with this thing. And there is continuous joy in the background, which the light itself emits. See, the light sounds very passive, but it's very rich. There are lots of very rich elements to the light. One of them is joy. That's very different than happiness. Happiness is circumstantial. Happiness is having more lumps than the guy, than the image next to you. I'm happy for my lumps. You know, circumstantial. Or I just have a mood that's light. Yeah, that's great, except turn around and it's gone. So that's not very satisfactory. But joy, the background from which we rest, on which we rest, remembering that the images, you and I, as an image, you and I, are the light. Sounds a little bit New Age-ish, I realize. Excuse me in that. I'm not a New Age fan. But it's just a metaphor I'm using at the moment. Because presence, awareness, aliveness. That's in each one of us. You know, in the beginning class, I say, you already have it. If you weren't aware, you'd be dead. And all we're going to do is access that awareness. If you didn't have awareness, you wouldn't. It's not like you have to go looking for it. It's there. Just figure out how to access it. It's already there. Each one of us is fully aware. It's just we've turned away from it. And so that's the whole journey, is to realize what's already there. You don't have to worry that you don't, like I hear, oh, you know, I don't really have what it takes to do this journey. You have what it takes to do the journey, you just decide you don't want to do the journey. Admit it, admit that. Let's be honest. If you want to cop out and say, oh, hell with it, I'll just accumulate lumps, then do. There's not a problem, it's just be honest. Because we could be much more if we wanted. Now that's true. And so what is it that where's the joy in my life? To ask that question from sincerity, not as a deprived, somebody that's deprived of joy, but kind of missing this. I feel miserable all the time. Where's the joy? And that doesn't send you on some kind of, you know, search and rescue mission. It's just, I'm misplacing this. There's something wrong here. Something's being skewed. I don't want to do that anymore to myself. Let the joy be seen. Let the joy be seen. Right. It's like when I've got a bunch of these little things I want to, questions I would for you to pose to yourself. From, I like doing that because sometimes it hits a chord and it really carries the spirit of the talk into your life. And if you find that I say something that you connect with, yeah, what am I, what's, then follow that. Let everything else go. Follow that because that's your lifeline. That's your lifeline. And so another, you know, when we find ourselves jealous and envious, so why am I believing this story? What, why? Because my head is all filled with the emotion of envy and I'm feeling very small, very left out. And if you just stayed there for a moment and felt that sense of being excluded and left out, you would find a series of memories that have repetitively brought that feeling to bear. And if you just, you can just, they're like card decks. They're, you know, like I have 52 memories of, and if you just like, you take that deck and you just fan it out. That's all it's got. Now why am I betraying the greater sense of myself for this limited story of envy and jealousy? Why is that story so compelling to me? Only because the past, we've assumed our place as an image within that story and played it out. An Oscar-nominated role. You don't have to do that. But you have to ask the question. Because once you ask the question, then you really see how you've betrayed yourself. How you've confined yourself to a pea shooter. To looking through a straw. What is blocking joy? This is the heart of meditation. The heart of meditation isn't sitting down laboriously following your breath. That's not the point. The point is the journey forward, beyond the images created, beyond the belief system, the assumptions that have backed us up, limited us, confined us. To become at home with ourselves, within the mind, so that the mind has nothing new to offer me. I know it so well. And I sit comfortably within all those stories. And as I sit more comfortably, the less angst, the less validity I give them. The less invested I become in them. And now I'm beginning to get very close to that one-way image, to that one-way mirror. And now as I approach it, no longer reeling from what I see from the images that's reflected, but as I approach it, I can see through it. It becomes transparent. Transparent in the sense that the wonder of life, the vastness of life, is perceived outside of that image, not within it. Within it, it is just me and you. Within it is a very tight relationship. But our willingness to venture into those images and to be able to stay and steady our attention sufficiently so that they no longer contain the absolute truth of our reality. And even as we're speaking here, perhaps a deeper sense of stillness. And what does that mean? It means we are approaching those images, no longer investing or recoiling from them. And as we get quieter, the sight from that quietude begins to pierce the transparency. And quiet is all we need. And suddenly, from being very limited and small, I feel the sense is of abundance, of space. And now, although the forms have not changed, the dance of the movie has continued across the screen, and it's a long movie. The whole thing has changed, and yet nothing has changed. Nothing has changed, and everything has changed. And so as belonging was to metta, the sense of centered perspective, so too abundance is to mudita, where we have cast out the sense of quantification. Okay. Can we sit for a minute or two? Let me sense abundance in this moment. Let me sense the abundance in this moment. Or as a reminder throughout the day, there's always enough for the heart. Always enough for the heart. So if there are any questions or comments about anything, you'd be happy to respond if I can.
Thank you.
So she's saying that sometimes when she thinks of the heart or feels the heart, it feels like sort of a lover that is having the experience of the love outside of herself, that there's kind of a space or a gap between that, right, between yourself. And that's a phase of practice. A phase of practice is the sense of somebody watching or somebody offering metta to yourself, you know. And it's a phase, and what's actually happening in that phase is that there is still a strong identification with the sense of the somebody who holds the images of oneself. And then there is an alternate place that I have now given some of my focus to, where there's subtle thoughts about me being better or different than the way I think I am over here. And that person is trying to share with them that sense of transference of love that this person over here feels, but this person over here can't fully accept. Right? So there's a feeling of a gap or a space. Okay, so what you don't want to do is to encourage any distance in that gap. Okay? So see if you have love for both. See if you have love for both voices. You have love for this person who doesn't feel available for the love, right? The one who sits over here. And then there's the alternative voice of metta who is trying to rally enough inspiration, enough lightheartedness to be able to deliver some metta to this person over here, right? But you don't want to become dissociated or siding with this one over this one, which increases the fraction or the distance or the gap. So love holds them both. So now what surrounds them both? I'm not going to pit one against the other. I'm not going to force one to join the other. I'm just going to sit with both equally in my heart. Equally in the heart. And what they'll do, if you don't make a big schism of them, is that they begin to come together. And then you have awareness without somebody outside perceiving. At that point, perhaps for the first time, we know love, because it's not coming from a trying to rebalancing. You realize the light has always been shining on you at that point, and that it can't possibly not shine on you, and that all you've ever done was interfere by shading that light from you, and you're not going to do that anymore. And so now you will drop whatever deep ingrained identification patterns you have which shades that light. And it may take a lot of work to come to that ease, but you get a sense that the light is always shining now. And this really speeds up the journey, because now you are truly loved, not artificially loved or attempting to love, but you are truly loved in that moment when there is only light shining. And so what the first thing you realize is that you can do anything and the light still shines. It's not moralistic light. It shines on the criminal, it shines on the saint. So that's pretty amazing. And the other thing is that once you feel the being held by this, you no longer want to do harm. Because that creates a shadow that takes you outside that light or blocks it from you. Because the only reason we'll ever do harm is because the image or the quantifiable image of me needs something from that person, and I'll do harm to them in order to get that. That's a very selfish, arrogant model of life to be lived. And you realize that the light is the most important thing, the love is the most important thing, and you're not going to create any shadows that in any way distort that love. And that's where ethical conduct falls into place. It doesn't fall into place from a should or a must or a have to or a belittlement. It falls into place because that's the nature of the way it's being seen. That's the nature of love, life lived in love. You see, so it starts working on you that way. The hardest, and perhaps where most of us are in this room, is trying to get some other perspective besides the walled, one-way mirrored room. You know, it's like you look around, you just see yourself, you feel all this stuff inside of you. And that's why from time to time, I will suggest going inside and looking what's really happening. I mean, what is it you're talking to? There's thoughts in there, there's emotions in there. There's a story going on. There's a lot of jumbled antics, you know, or images. Okay, let's sort through that stuff. What's really happening there? Not what I assume is happening there and playing out those images, but what's really happening there is not much. Just really a story that's being formed. And if I can question that story, I can question the model of the reflection in the images. Is this true? Is what I'm saying to myself true in this moment? It was a very limited perspective. One-sided, very opinionated, reactive. You see, that's the way Buddhism encourages the lack of it, the loss of the investment in the image, by questioning, looking. Okay, it's a very important question. She's saying, well, look at the person who's addicted or the alcoholic who never gets enough. How does that fit into abundance? It doesn't, not if it's quantifiable. I mean, the alcohol is never satiated with enough alcohol. So in terms of quantifying, if you think of abundance in terms of how much I'm getting, it doesn't stack up, does it? Okay, so here's how it stacks up. There's a sense in us of being malcontent in that moment, of not having enough. Okay? That sense of not having enough can drive us towards the quantification image of trying to get more. It can do that and has done it and does do it, and that's why we call ourselves alcoholic or whatever we call ourselves. That's one way it can do it. There's also a way in which that can't do anything to us. When we feel discontent, I'm still feeling discontent, but I'm not allowing that state of mind to move me in the direction of replenishing, of trying to fill it up. Because I realize, having tried to do it that way, it never fills up. And so that state of mind no longer has the allure or the promise, doesn't hold the promise that it will ever be able to fill me up. And therefore, I'm not even listening to that state of mind anymore. Now I have abundance even though I'm still discontent. Now that's amazing, because now you are more settled than what your mind says you are. As long as the discontent stirs us sufficiently to seek quantifying more, then I will. And I will forever be an alcoholic on that, because as soon as that gets stimulated, it gets encouraged and reinforced, and it'll come up again and again more often in the future than it has in the past. But when I realize that that doesn't work, it's called bottoming out. I realize that's not going to work to be enslaved to that level of need. Now, the strength in me is stronger than the state of mind in me. And there's abundance that's felt. And it doesn't take long before that state of mind that feels discontent changes to actually feeling abundant. So now you're in line with the actual feeling of abundance, which is much easier than holding the abundance in a state of misery. Are people following this? Just a minute. Now you have walked through the image and you are now looking out through the glass. Not, the image doesn't tell you everything about your life, you see. I'm not enough, I've got it's like, okay, I don't give a damn. Now, there's the image, the way it used to be. Now it's like, oh yeah. Uh-huh. Yes.
So you use your allegory of looking through the mirror, so that one apprehends simultaneously the form of the image and beyond to the non-form of reality. I wonder if the one that's looking is also
okay, the question, it's a good question, thank you. The question is to use the analogy of looking through the one-way mirror and seeing through form to the formless. Is the person that's looking also formlessness, seeing formlessness? Okay, the way you perceive will be how you hold yourself. If you see the formless, there won't be a sense of you. When formlessness is perceived, there isn't someone perceiving it. There just isn't. If you perceive each person as an image, I guarantee you that you're perceiving from the sense of your own image, because that's the way an image is formed. It's from your past, your memories, which is your image, projecting out the images that you see. So the sights, the perceptions you have are concurrent with the way you're holding yourself. Now, so that's why there's such an emphasis in any authentic spiritual journey of seeing through the sense of self as formless. Now, you're not going to get to the light unless that's perceived. As you perceive yourself, oh, all the things I thought about what I was, when I look at them, they're just, I don't know what they are. They're just images. So what are we going to gather around and claim to be true? And when that's allowed to rest, then everyone that is perceived in exactly that same way. And simultaneously, I have to know where my car is and I have to get back home. Simultaneously, that does not interrupt. Those two things do not interrupt. They're not two ways of seeing. They sound like they're two ways of seeing, but they're actually one in the same way. Even as you are walking towards the car, the light is accompanying you all along the way. Okay, we have to call. Thank you. You make me work. Thank you.